My name is Wayne Ingersoll. It's March 2nd, 1988. I'm interviewing Clifford Eagle. Cliff lives at 1212 Fifth Avenue South in Moorhead. And primary purpose of this interview is to get a little background on Cliff's early life, and particularly we're going to zero in primarily in the interview toward the middle on Cliff's experiences in World War I. He is a World War I veteran. Cliff, would you give us your name and your address and your age, please? Sure. Your name and address and age.
My name is Cliff Eagle. Live at 1212 6th Avenue South, Moorhead. And I'll be 92 years old my next birthday, next June.
Okay. And where were you born, Cliff?
I was born in Fertile, Minnesota.
In
1896.
And what were the names of your parents?
I have many of my parents. My father was William Wilson Eagle. My mother was Emma Sophia Erickson, or Engelstad. I wasn't too sure which it was, because their name was Engelstad when they came over from Norway. And after they'd been here a while, then the children changed their name to Erickson.
What did your father do, Cliff?
Father was a barber and a photographer.
And where did he get his photography training? Do you have any
Well,
idea
he bought out a place that had a photo gallery upstairs in the building. Okay. And he was a barber otherwise. That was his main business as barber.
At that time, barbers gave a lot of shaves, didn't they?
They what?
They gave a lot of shaves at that time, didn't
well,
they?
Well, at that time, the barbers worked. They used to shave you for 10 cents and cut your hair for a quarter.
I would say that's quite interesting.
And most of their business was on Saturday. Very little of it from Saturday through Friday.
So their living was made on one day a week.
But he used to go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning on Friday, on Saturday, and work after midnight.
Now, let's get back to your parents. Now, your parents would no longer be living. When did they die, Phil?
Well,
Cliff, I'm sorry.
My father died on March 25th, 1908.
You were quite young then. You were only
and
about
I was,
14.
I was about 11 years old 11. At the time. Okay. And my mother died in 1954.
I see.
I believe it is either June or July 1954.
Okay. What nationality or ethnic background are you in your
well,
family?
I'm just writing up a family history now. But my father was born down Riceville, Iowa, but his parents were both from England. And they couldn't get married in England at that time, so they eloped and came over here. The reason for it was that my grandfather, his father, was a gardener for my grandmother's father.
All right. Oh, class system.
Yeah. My grandmother's father owned a bunch of land around that country. My grandfather's father didn't own anything.
Okay. And how about your mother? What is her nationality?
Mother, she's Norwegian.
She's primarily Norwegian.
And she came over with her father, mother, and three sisters and two brothers, I think it was.
Okay. They came
over from Norway in 1881.
Okay. As long as we're on your family, did you have any brothers or do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have one brother still living out in California. It's on Santa Cruz.
Is he older than you or younger?
He's younger.
Okay. Were there any other brothers and sisters in the family?
I have two other brothers. One was Brother Bill that owned a drugstore up at Crookston. He was a pharmacist also. And the other brother, Floyd, was the youngest brother of the boys. He was he got up to be a branch manager for Nash Finch.
Okay.
They sent him finally, he was at Jamestown for a while, and then they finally sent him down to Kansas.
Okay. We're going to still stay in Fertile for a while. It seems to me this last summer there was a big gathering in Fertile, and you were one of the oldest living graduates of the high school. It was an article in the paper. Would you explain what took, first of all, when did you finish school in Fertile, and explain about this last summer, if you would, Cliff?
Well, I finished high school in Fertile in 1914. And what was going on up at Fertile this year was a centennial celebration of the town. And the school, high school, Fertile High School graduate was from the school there in 1901. Okay. So you see, there hadn't been many graduates before us. And So they had the all school get together besides. And there was a lot of them there from all over the United States. And there's one girl lives up there. She's a classmate of mine. She's older than I am.
How many were in your class who graduated in 14?
There's a big sum of nine.
All right. And how many are still living?
As far as I know, she and I are the only two of our class, although it's possible that there's one living in California.
All right.
One girl from a class before me is a resident of a nursing home up at Yulin.
Okay. Good. Did you find that, did you see a lot of people this summer at the gathering you hadn't seen for quite a while?
Well, I didn't. I saw a lot of some people that I knew, but I had a lot of the younger kids come up to me and talk to me and say, oh, my father and my mother, they talked about you.
Okay.
But there weren't too many of the older ones like that. Like, we were about the two oldest ones. In fact, we were the two oldest ones there.
Now, we're going to get to the World War I area shortly, but you said you graduated from high school in 1914, and you are a retired pharmacist. What is your educational background after high school? Where did you go? Where did you get your advanced education?
Well, while I went to high school, and for a year and a half afterwards, I worked in the printing business.
In the what business?
In the printing business.
All right.
And then I left there and went to work in a drugstore. Well, I worked in a drugstore for a while, and then, of course, I got into service. After I got out again, I had enough time in so I could take the examinations.
Okay. I was touching this, and I can't do that. Okay, go ahead.
I was going to see if there's any water or something around here. My mouth's getting dry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, where were we?
Okay, we were at the point. My question was, where did you get your training and your education to become a pharmacist? And you had been into printing, and then you were working in a drugstore.
Well, at that time, if you worked 4 years in a drugstore under a registered pharmacist, and you could pass the examinations for the state board, which were given at the University of Minnesota at that time, you could automatically get your papers. Mm-hmm. However, there was a little school down in Minneapolis that was called the Minnesota Institute of Pharmacy. There was an old Dr. Drew that ran it, and he was one of the smartest old boys I ever saw in my life.
Did you go there too?
I went there for a short time in 1919.
Okay.
And then in 1920 I went there for a shorter time.
When did you become a registered pharmacist?
I became a registered pharmacist in April 1920.
You were about 24 years old at that mm-hmm. time then. What was your...
Thank you.
After you became a registered pharmacist, what did you... Where did you practice your trade?
Well, I went back to Fertile because my brother, older brother was a pharmacist, and he was working there at the time. He didn't get into service because one of us boys had to stay home. We were the two oldest. One of us had to stay home to help take care of the family. And so I went back home afterwards. Well, he immediately told me, he said, you're going to stay home now and take over the job where I am. And he says, I'm going to go out and get around a bit. He says, I've had to stay home all the time instead of this, see? So I stayed there, and I worked until 1927. From 1920 until 1927 for an old fellow by the name of Nels Bossenden.
What kind of wages did you earn at that time as a pharmacist in the drugstore?
Well, before I got into service, I was making $35 a month.
All right.
After I got back out, and he started paying me $75 a month. After I got my papers, he paid me $125 a month.
Was that considered a pretty good wage at that time?
It was good pay. It's one of the best paying jobs in the town at that time. But that back in 19, right after World War I, nobody was making big money then.
Right.
I know when I was a kid, laborers up there were working in the brickyard, and they'd get paid 10 cents an hour for their work, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Well, it goes to show what an education will do as far as earning power,
yeah.
Doesn't it? All right, up until 1927, then you worked in, what did you do after that in pharmacy?
Well, 1927, I left the store and went to work for a wholesale drug house in St. Paul, Noyes, Brothers & Cutler.
In sales?
In sales, yeah, on the road.
Okay.
And
did they sell just pharmaceutical? Did they sell just drugs and pharmaceuticals, or what was their product
they
line?
They sold everything that was sold in a drugstore.
All right. Okay. More than drugs then.
But then, well, at that time, as I say, sundries, anything right. Like electrical stuff, and all the rest of it.
Okay.
The junk you might say that you expected to find in a store. But I only stayed with them 6 months. I knew that after 3 months I would be leaving them. I was offered a job with the Rexall Drug Company. I didn't even think I'd be able to get a chance, and I never asked for it, but they came and asked me if I wanted to go to work.
In what capacity?
What is that?
In what capacity for Rexall?
As a salesman.
All right.
They didn't know where they were going to put me at first, but after I did go to work for them, I went into Boston for 2 weeks. Had a training in stage to learn more about their business, although I had been working in a Rexall drugstore for a good number of years before that, so I knew the line pretty well.
They must have known you pretty well, more so than you were aware of.
What is that?
They must have known you pretty well, more than you were aware of.
Well, the way it happened was that the district manager in his ear didn't know who I was very much. But there was an old boy that was one of their best salesmen that was up in through here, and he was leaving to buy a drugstore for himself. And so they wanted a man in place of him. So and this fellow came up to interview or look around for somebody. And he was telling this old salesman who he had in mind, the other salesmen that were on the road. Old Andy says, he isn't the guy you want. And he mentioned me. And so old the district manager says, well, he says, who is he? He says, I don't know. But he told me, well, he said, I know, but there's a small town. He hasn't had any experience. And he says, well, he says, he's a registered pharmacist by now. He's been in the Army. He's been around a bit. He says, I think maybe he might qualify for it.
What year was that you went with Rexall?
That was in 1927.
And you stayed with Rexall?
No, I went to work for Rexall. I went on their payroll on December 19th, 1927.
And then how long did you stay with
them? I stayed with them until January 1st, I think it was, January 2nd, 1964.
64, okay. And you were an on-the-road salesman?
I was on the road. When I first got back into Minneapolis, they put me to work out of Minneapolis, working territory around through there and up through Duluth and as far as Bemidji and so forth, because the man that was there regularly had broken a leg. And so they...
Did you sell again all the kinds of things one would find in a drugstore?
Well, everything that Rexall handled and made.
All right.
See, they made a lot of their own stuff, all their own drugs, and over-the-counter medicines and so forth. They had some pharmaceuticals along with it, and they had a great big line of cosmetics. They had their own line of surgical supplies and dressings. They had two places, one in St. Louis and one in someplace in the East. And they owned the Seamless Rubber Company also that made all of the rubber supplies, that hot water bottles and things of that type.
I would think the fact that you were a registered pharmacist made a lot of difference in your ability to sell your product.
Well, you...
There aren't too many sales people today who are registered pharmacists, are there?
Oh, yes.
There
are? Very few. Well, I won't say there are very few. There are still boys on the road that are registered pharmacists. But I know when I left Rexall, I was the last few years, I was the only one of the bunch that was registered. But it was Rexall's initial rule that before you could go to work for him, you had to be a registered pharmacist, and you had to have had experience working in a drugstore.
I see.
So you had to have all of that before you could work for him.
What was your territory, Cliff?
Well, my first territory was out of Minneapolis there. I got as far west as Wilmer, came up to Fergus Falls, Detroit Lakes, and cut up toward Bemidji, up to International Falls, and then back again. I didn't have Duluth. Yes, I had Duluth at that time, too. And then back to the cities. But it is a draw line east and west out of Minneapolis over towards Wilmer. And then it cut it up, as I say, from Wilmer to Fergus Falls, and then cut off the angle like that. That was my territory at first. I was only there for about 6 months, and then they sent me out to western North Dakota, Montana. At that time, my territory was west of Jamestown and Devil's Lake, and out as far as Havre and Great Falls, down through Roundup, Billings, and then back in toward Jamestown again.
Now, when you retired in 1964, what was your territory at that time?
Oh, my territory then, that had been cut down. When I first went to work for him, I had that of 75 accounts in there. Mm-hmm. And when I left them, I was down to 23 accounts.
Were they bigger accounts, or?
Well, I hadn't been successful enough in getting the even some little stores. I know Fertile was one of the good ones. Henning, Minnesota was one of my best little ones. Mm-hmm. Because a young fellow was in there that I had known who he was, but I didn't know him before. But he was willing to listen and do things. And that is the main thing. Of course, the strength of selling is explaining to the customer how he can sell it, how he can put it across. And if you can get him to listen to you and you've got any ideas, why, that's all it takes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your family. You told us about your parents and your brothers and sisters in Fertile. When did you get married? And who did you marry?
Well, I married a gal by the name of Wilma Barlow.
Okay.
The way I happened to meet her was out of Jamestown. Bismarck. I first met her at Dickinson. She was working out in that area, too, because she worked for the North Dakota Power Light Company out of Bismarck at that time as a home service worker for him.
And when did you meet her?
Well, we met her in the, we just met out of Dickinson, and then we didn't go together or do anything again until, a few months later.
When was that? What year?
That was 1931.
All right.
And then later on we happened to meet at Bismarck again, because I was up visiting a friend of mine and his wife. He was newly married and everything, and she came up to visit him also because she knew this fellow's wife. That's how we met. At that time we were together, but well, we just didn't go together very long.
When did you get married?
Because we were married in the spring.
Okay.
Yeah, we were married March 24th.
And you know, I know you have two children.
I have a boy, son, and a daughter, yeah.
Would you tell us their ages and their names?
Well,
Nancy,
my daughter might object to it, but she's, of course, not too young. She's about 54.
All right.
We'll be 54 this month.
And her name is Nancy?
And my son, her name is Nancy, right. Mrs. Loy. She's living back here now.
I know, I met her last summer.
And my son Bill, he's 4 years younger, so he'll be 50 this coming July.
Okay. And I've known Bill since I've
You've
been
known him for
since
long.
We've been little kids.
Most people in Moorhead know Bill.
Sure.
Much better than they know me.
Oh, I know that. I believe that. Okay. Good enough. Let's go back to when you lived in Fertile. This is something a little bit different from what the interview was on before we get into World War I. Did you know James D. Mason in Fertile?
I worked for him.
You did. Would you tell me about him as much as you can, what he did? Tell me about him.
Well, J.D. Mason, before he came to Fertile, was a superintendent of schools at Twin Valley.
All right.
And he made, I don't know what her name was beforehand. I can't remember it. But she wasn't from up around Fertile. He was married when he came to Fertile. They had a family at that time. And I first started working in a printing office under a fellow by the name of Frank Raff, who is, by the way, a cousin of Ines Ortner's father.
Right.
But anyway, he... J.D. Mason bought him out, and I stayed on with him until I decided to go to work in a drugstore.
Are any of his family still in Fertile, Mason's family?
In family in Fertile?
Yes.
No. No, one of his son, oldest son, used to be a judge down out of Mankato. And I don't know where, I think Milton's still there. I know I met his sister up at the Fertile Reunion.
Right. When did J.D. Mason die?
What is that?
When did J.D. Mason die? When did he?
I don't remember when he died. See, at that time I had left Fertile and I wasn't around there anymore.
Can you give me a ballpark year in 1930s, 1940s?
At what?
When he died, was it during the 30s or the 40s?
That I have no idea.
No. So the reason I ask, he went to the normal school here.
I know. He was one of the original guys from the OWL organization.
Right.
He used to tell me a few things about that.
What are some of the things he used to tell you that
you
can recall?
One of the main things he told me about was, he said there was an old house they used to have as their meetings. And they'd sometimes get up in the attic. And they would kind of hoot like an owl. Scare the daylights out of people going by sometimes. And he said they got a big kick out of that. Well, if you knew J.D. Mason afterwards, as you got older, you wouldn't ever believe that he had done anything even like that.
I think it was interesting because when he went to the normal school, he was about 35 years old at that time.
Yeah, he wasn't a young man.
No, not at all. Okay.
I know he thought he was paying me too much money when I worked for him at $12 a week.
Well, he wouldn't have paid you if you weren't worth it, would he?
Well,
you must have been worth the $12.
We got in a little argument, and I told him if he didn't like it, why? He gave me my check. He said, "You'll get it." And I did.
And you parted ways.
But we parted friends otherwise, but I mean, he tried to get me to come back to work for him afterwards.
Well, that speaks well
but
of
I
you.
Said, "No, absolutely not." I said, "I'm out of the printing business. I'm going to stay out of it."
Okay. World War One.
Yeah.
When did you enter the service?
I got into service on May 18, 1918.
Were you drafted?
I registered for the draft. But before that, after I had registered and before I was called, I noticed an article in the paper where they wanted fellows in a medical corps. And I figured being in a drugstore and things of that time, it'd do me more good to get in there than someplace else, and I could do more in my line of work also. For them.
So you enlisted?
I wrote in to Washington, D.C. about it. And they accepted me. They told me that they would notify me when to come. Well, before I got that, I got a notice from Washington, D.C. because another fellow and myself had taken some exams. I just went up with the other guy to take an exam for, I don't know what department, insurance department or something like that. For the government at the time. Anyway, I got a wire from it, and I didn't know what to do. So I wired back and wanted to know if it exempted me from service. If it did, I'd make up my mind what I wanted to do. If it didn't, I wasn't about to take the job and get there and then be drafted otherwise. But I got a wire back from them saying it didn't exempt me, so I notified them that would be it.
Where did you enter the service?
Well, I went down to Fort Wright of Kansas.
Okay.
That's where I had to, that was a medical corps down there.
And after you got to Fort Riley and went through your training, then where did you go?
Well, I was in Fort Riley until September of that year as a casual. And then they sent
me. What does that mean, casual? I don't know.
Well, you were really unassigned.
All right. Okay.
And then they sent me to Fort Snelling. They eliminated Fort Snelling at that time as a training place for the infantry. And our first job up there was to take and clean up all the old infantry barracks. They had a good-sized hospital there otherwise. But we also had to clean up all those infantry barracks and make wards out of them. So we had a lot of cleaning up and bed making and all that stuff to do. So I still know how to make beds.
Now, after September in Fort Snelling, did you stay in Fort Snelling throughout your service time? Or
I stayed in Fort Snelling then until August 9th, 1919, when I was discharged.
You were in after the war ended. You were in nearly a year then, weren't you?
What is that?
After the war ended, you were in nearly another year.
Oh, yeah. We were in there the war was over in November, and we didn't get out until August.
Okay.
But the reason they had to keep us in there was because they didn't have enough other help in that line to handle a hospital, see?
Uh-huh.
We all had our different jobs there, of course, to take care of. Some of us were even on ward, guard duty, because the hospital ran the whole place.
Of all of the time you were in the service during World War One and shortly thereafter, what was it? Can you name any one particular incident or occurrence that took place during your time in the service that you remember more than any other?
I can't say anything too much out of the way, although I was there at the time the 151st Field Artillery came home. And I was playing with a band at Fort Snelling at the time.
What did you play?
I played trumpet.
Okay.
And besides that, there was a fellow by the name of Joe Lurson that had a bunch of orchestras in St. Paul before that, and so we organized an orchestra out of Fort Snelling along with the rest of it. So between my regular job and the band work and the orchestra work, we were kept busy, kept out of mischief.
What was your rank when you were discharged in 1990?
What?
What was your rank when you were discharged?
I was just a corporal.
Okay. Did you continue to play the trumpet off and on after the
service? Oh, yeah. I had my own dance band after we got home for a while.
Tell us about that.
Up around Fertile there. Well, it was just a family band is what it was. My brother lives in California yet. He was a trombone player. My sister played piano. And I played a trumpet. And the other two brothers played some, but they didn't get in with us at all. And then there's a little boy next door to us that played drums. And there's another man that maybe some people around here might know, a Gronigan, Muggins Gronigan.
Sounds like an Irishman.
Huh?
Sounds like an Irishman with a name
like
that.
His father was a minister. I first met Muggins down in Fort Riley, Kansas. He was originally from up here in North Dakota someplace, but when we got back home, after being in service, first guy I met on the street was Muggins. He was already a home then, too. And I said, what are you doing over here? Oh, he's my dad's a preacher over here now. He had moved over there during the war to become a minister in a couple of the churches in and around Fertile. But he was a marvelous tuba player. So that was our orchestra around there. No strings. It was always had been strings or something like that in an orchestra. But we were one of the first all brass.
And how long did that brass band last?
Well, we stayed there, I don't know, just about the time I left there, I think. I left there just a year before the 9th District Band was organized.
When you say the 9th District Band, you have to explain. What do you mean, though? I don't understand.
Well, the American Legion, 9th District Band.
American Legion.
Yeah. In fact, I was one of the guys that helped organize the American Legion up there.
Well, good. As we were coming in here, I was asking you about the World War One veterans in Fargo-Moorhead, and you said you meet once a month.
Yeah.
Where do you meet?
We meet in the YMCA over there.
And how many show up now?
Well, the last couple of times, I think the last time, I think there was about 9 of us there. And that's about the least that has been there.
Approximately how many World War One veterans are living in Fargo and Moorhead? Do you have a number?
I have no idea as to that, but our barracks, that's what they call the unit that we are in. Our barracks, I believe Floyd Henderson said, was around 200 and some members. Now, that doesn't include just Fargo and Moorhead. That includes part of Minnesota and part of North Dakota also.
All right.
A lot of them don't come or anything. In fact, a year ago, they had it all fixed up so we could become life members of the organization by paying in just a few dollars. And so I think practically everyone, what we did with it anyway, was the fellows that didn't have the money to pay in for a life membership, the unit furnished the money for them.
As we were coming in, I was mentioning, I read recently, there are 4 or 5 Spanish-American War veterans in the United States yet.
Yet?
Yes, 4 or 5. They're all gentlemen, have to be 106, 107 years old, the youngest.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are still a few.
Yeah.
Still a few. Fargo had one, Peter Peterson. back, and Peter died in about 1980,
1981. Oh, yeah, he was originally from up around northwestern Minnesota, northeast of here.
All right. Did you ever know him or meet him?
No, I never met him. I was in the hospital one time, and I know they were talking about him. He was having a birthday at that time. I think at that time it was his 106th or 107th birthday.
I met him in 1978 or 1979, and introduced me to him, and he was a Spanish-American war veteran. He said, yep. He said, I remember when I went over on the Maine or something. I said, Peter, that's another century. And he said, oh, yeah, yeah. Fine old gentleman.
Well, I remember when I was a kid, there were still some old Civil War veterans living up at Fertile.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you recall their names, Cliff?
Well, one by the name of Courtright and another one by the name of Chase. But I can't remember any others up there. But I know that those, they were saying that those two fellows were old Civil War vets. So.
Well, that's interesting. We're sitting in this room, and you've been acquainted with Civil War veterans.
Yeah.
You probably knew them quite well.
So all of a sudden, I reached back a little ways too, see?
Yeah. You were too?
Between our ages and theirs, we could almost span close to 200 years,
yes,
175 anyway.
Yes, you could. Cliff, that's all the questions I have. Want to thank you for your interview. Is there anything else that you would care to add regarding your World War I experiences, business, family, anything?
Excepting that by working for an outfit like I did for, I've got a lot of travel out of it. See, when I first went to work for them, Rexall was located, their home offices were located in Boston, Massachusetts. So we were in there repeatedly for at least once a year for meetings. Then later on, they built a big place down in St. Louis, a big modern factory down there, although they had factories in Boston and Mansfield, Massachusetts, New Haven, Connecticut. They had factories in all those places. And we got a lot of travel out of it, because I remember meetings that we had there in Chicago, St. Louis, and Dallas, Texas, Denver, Los Angeles. So as I say, we had a little travel out of it. Most of the time, of course, we would travel by train earlier when I first went to work. Later on, we started going by plane.
It sounds to me like it was a good company to work for.
They were a marvelous company to work for. And, like when we were in Boston, at least one night, we were invited out to Louis K. Liggett's home. He was the originator and the president of the company. And they treated us all just like we were they were just as common as we were, let's put it that way. And, but they knew where their bread and butter was coming from, too. The more we worked at a job, the better all of us them was.
Well, I want to thank you very much. This
entirely
has been
welcome.
An extremely interesting interview, and appreciate it.
I couldn't quite figure from those questions at first what you were...
Well, I had to send you something.
Yeah. Well, that is all right.
Okay. Cliff, all right. Thank you.
Yeah.